This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Talked previously about our translational work in Alzheimer's disease and our work in spinal cord injury. And as I was thinking about the best topic to relate, I came back to the whole concept of translational neuroscience. And what's new, what's changing, what could impact the practice of clinical neurology arising from the basic science realm. And I thought it was the right time to talk about personalized medicine, about genomic medicine, about what the new tools that have been made available in this phenomenal era of science might do to impact the clinic, particularly since this concept of personalized medicine is such a central concept to medicine here at UCSD in particular. The dean here has identified, quote, personalized medicine. By the way, what does that mean? But has identified personalized medicine as one of the key objectives in the development of medicine here. And I think he's right on target with that. We do live in this remarkable era of genomics discovery, and this really is already impacting clinical medicine and clinical neurology to a more limited degree at this point, but it is clearly an emerging tool that I think will become a mainstay of the repertoire of every one of us as we treat patients in the next 10 and 20 years. And I don't know that it's a field that most of us know that much about, and it's hard for me to see you actually because of that spotlight. Now I can see you. I don't know if you can see me, but by a show of hands, how many people here feel comfortable with the concept of examining the genome in the context of your patients? Do you even know what that means? Do you know that how you would get your patient's genome and how you might make medical decisions with that? If anyone feels comfortable with that, raise your hand. Look at that, not one hand. So, gee, maybe this is a relevant topic. But what do I know about it? Well, I've been using it as a tool in our preclinical research for the last about 6 to 7 years. And so I have learned a fair bit about it in the context of trying to do neuroscience translational discovery research. And so I thought I would pretty much talk about that today, but try to put it in the context of introducing this concept and urging everybody to become more familiar with it. And I think that as part of the residency, it would make sense for us to begin to talk about this and maybe even have a series of dedicated lectures to the emerging concept and the clinical use of genomic medicine. So with the somewhat humorous title of the Grand Rounds, which I haven't replicated here because it was too humorous, I'm sure you were all dying laughing from the title, I said something like, personalized medicine for the rat with spinal cord injury. Because, you know, what that means is that we are examining, as one of our research programs, spinal cord injury and how we can try and generate repair. And there has been some decent progress in the field in general and in our work, too, in the last few years. And as we have made progress in making axons grow, we've started using these new tools of molecular drug discovery to try and understand better why axons are growing and how we might amplify those responses using the tools of personalized medicine. So that's what we'll talk about today. And I just need, I guess I forward myself on my computer. So this will be a talk about omics, because that's really, so, you know, what is personalized medicine? It's kind of a odd term, I think, because I don't know what that means, because we all do personalized medicine. We see a patient, we interact with that person, and we tailor our diagnosis and therapy to that accordingly. So I actually think it's a somewhat poor term to describe the bringing into the practice of clinical medicine of the tools of genomics, proteomics, lipidomics, metabolomics, what are called omics. So we'll talk a little bit about these omics concepts. Is there a laser pointer? Does anyone have one that they can hand over? If not, I guess what I can do is point with this.
Yeah, they kind of like you to do that because then they can record where the
mouse is. Yeah, okay. All right, so I'll try to point with this. I prefer to stand up there, but I guess I'll stand here. So personalized medicine refers to the use of omic data in the context of either neuroscience discovery or in the treatment of your patients. And omics basically means taking data sets that are based on genes, proteins, the phosphorylation state of proteins, the state of lipids, the state of metabolic processes, and using high-throughput screening methods to derive data about each of these processes to somehow assemble all of this information and draw a conclusion. Oh, thank you very much. So most of the discussion about personalized medicine relates to the analysis of genes from an individual patient. Now, some of you old enough to remember how important the sequencing of the human genome was about, 15 years ago. And the government put in billions of dollars to achieve this monumental goal at the time of sequencing the human genome. And that was accomplished. The tools, and that sequencing project took about 5 years. The tools have so rapidly advanced in the technology for sequencing the genome that we could do the same amount of work in about 2 weeks today. And we can each get our individual genomes entirely sequenced within this period of about 2 weeks, form an individual, and we can know the state of every one of our 20 or 1,000 or so genes. Even beyond that now, we can look at the states of what these genes are expressing per se. So we can get a snapshot at a specific point in time of all of the genes that are being expressed and the expression levels of each of those genes. And that can revolutionize how we understand the genomic state of the individual and in turn how that affects the expression of disease. So that's the kind of information that we can use today. And so most of this technology has focused on this development of analysis of the transcriptome. But now new methods have come along as well for doing the same sort of thing with the protein component of the cell. So we can take a cell, we can do a proteomic analysis and identify the proteins in the cell, the full complement of proteins, and in addition, their state of phosphorylation, which is often related to their state of activity. You can do the same thing with lipids, so you can establish something called the lipidome, and you can do the same thing with the metabolic state of a cell. Hence, these analyses are called the omics, but most of what personalized medicine is focusing on these days, because the technology has advanced that far and a lot of information is there, is in genomic data or the transcriptome. So that is really what personalized medicine refers to. So here are some examples of how this omic data is being used today to guide therapy. So we can sequence a tumor genome to identify specific mutations in the genome of the tumor that would define its potential vulnerability to specific sets of chemotherapy drugs. And that's being done quite extensively these days by people in the cancer field. And perhaps Santosh Kasari is using this tool in his work. I would imagine he is. We also currently today do whole genome sequencing on an individual who presents with cancer to see if they have a mutation in one of their oncogenes that is dictating vulnerability to cancer. And if we find a specific mutation, one may know in that person that they have a very high likelihood of developing ovarian cancer, as well as, let's say, the breast cancer they came in with, or hepatocellular cancer that's also associated with the risk of developing another cancer. So you can prophylactically screen these individuals, maybe do a prophylactic mastectomy or whatever is necessary to protect their future health. So genomic sequencing is becoming more and more prevalent and applied for that kind of an application. We heard a very nice grand rounds about 6 weeks ago from a visitor who talked about genomic sequencing to identify mutations in undiagnosed disorders like neurodevelopmental disorders. And this is an area of really broadening potential impact in pediatric neurology. And the potential exists today to sequence every one of our genomes in this room and for each of us to identify, based on what we know today about genes and their patterns of expression, what we might be vulnerable with regard to specific disease states. And again, that technology is present now. I've done whole genome sequencing probably on 1,000 rats up to this point. And I haven't done my own genome, but I'm really tempted. And at the same time, of course, you know, so what's my APOE genotype going to be? And am I going to be wildly demented, you know, in another 20 years? I mean, what kind of information do we want? Society is just beginning to sort through this. But today, the technology exists at relatively low cost. If you were to do this and pay for it out of pocket commercially, you'd pay about $1,000 to sequence your entire genome and have before you a list of potential vulnerabilities to various diseases. That could certainly guide your future health. But you may also have information you may not want to have. So this is an evolving area of discussion and ethics in medicine today. We also don't know as much about what broad patterns of gene expression really imply for many aspects of health. But there is an initiative now, again, funded by the NIH, to do whole genome sequencing on something like 100,000 people that will substantially add to the database and let us know what particular patterns of genomic expression carry with regard to disease risk. So this is an expanding, burgeoning area. And it's beginning today, and it's arisen in the last 10 to 20 years from remarkable advances in molecular technology, in information processing, bioinformatics, and so forth. So it's something that will change medicine. It's something that we all need to learn about. And as I say, I think it should be part of residency training. So the way that we obtain information about the genome, or the transcriptome, as we tend to refer to it more commonly, is with these methods. And these are some of the methods for identifying what our genome state is. They include the original high-throughput method called GeneArray that basically had primer oligonucleotides to probe particular genes and their gene products. But this has advanced to more sophisticated technology that now allows us to sequence the pool of messenger RNAs that are being actively expressed in a cell at any one time. And there are a variety of methods and a variety of terms. It's broadly called RNA sequencing or RNA-seq, so people in the field refer to this as RNA-seq, and it includes the various techniques that are called deep sequencing, whole exome sequencing, and other techniques that can probe the actual pool of mRNAs in various levels of detail within a cell. And then there are other forms of bioinformatic analysis of the transcriptional state that include studies of DNA methylation, microRNAs, non-coding RNAs. This is all an expanding field. Mostly what I'll talk about today, though, is the messenger RNA component of cells. But these techniques exist, they're commonly employed, and they're becoming more and more utilized in the clinical arena. These RNA-directed techniques provide a snapshot of the pool of actively transcribed messenger RNAs in a cell at one point in time. So if I take a skin biopsy for myself now and I do RNA sequencing on it, then it will tell me at this moment what my active pool of messenger RNAs are. And you'll see how we can use this kind of information to better understand disease in just a moment. And this is what the outputs of these analyses look like. We see the genes that are expressed on the relative expression levels. There are a variety of ways of presenting the data. This is a heat map, and genes that are actively expressed are red by convention in this field, and genes that are at a lower level of expression are typically colored green in this type of representation. So I'll show you some data like that. So let me show you what I know best, which is not how this is being applied clinically, but preclinically, to try and further translational neuroscience discovery research to develop therapies for spinal cord injury based on neural stem cell biology. And there are many people in my lab who work on these topics. The four highlighted in yellow here have made particular contributions to the transcriptome analyses I'll be talking about today. So Andy Adler, Jennifer Doolin, Gunnar Poplowski, and Erna Vanjekirk. So this is the biological question to which we apply these transcriptomic techniques. So here's the spinal cord, and obviously human spinal cords fail to regenerate after injury. And this is an area of great unmet medical need. We have no pro-regenerative therapies today. And one of the great areas of advance in basic neuroscience discovery research has been to understand why this is the case. And we've pretty much boiled it down to the extent of our knowledge today, to these four factors. First, in an established spinal cord injury, you have a cystic fluid-filled lesion cavity, and axons don't regenerate over water. They need some sort of molecular or cellular substrate to which they can attach, and having an empty cavity doesn't provide that mechanism. Secondly, growth factors are not produced in appropriate temporal and spatial gradients to support axon regrowth, whereas they are after peripheral nerve injury. Not only are these permissive factors lacking in the injured CNS, but there are actually two broad sets of inhibitory proteins that block active regeneration after injury. One is a set of proteins associated with myelin. So myelin tends to restrain the growth state of the adult nervous system, likely a function related to maintaining the organization of the established nervous system. And then a second class of inhibitors are extracellular matrix molecules. You know, hyaluronic acid is one of the main extracellular matrix molecules in our body. But after an injury, new cells come in and they change that extracellular matrix from hyaluronic acid to things like chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans. And these actively block the regeneration of axons. So you have a lack of stimulating factors and the presence of several inhibitors to growth. In addition to that, the adult, let's say, corticospinal motor neuron located up here in the cortex that has its axon transected here, in the adult, it's thought that it doesn't upregulate a full set of genes to enable really robust regeneration. So there are these neuron intrinsic mechanisms, and then there are these effects of the environment that limit regeneration. So on the background of all of this lack of growth, this slide illustrates that effect. So here's a rat spinal cord. This is a horizontal section through the spinal cord, so not coronal, but let's see. In this plane, going serially back like this. So this is a horizontal section. I'll show you a few pictures like this. The head is to the left, the tail is to the right. And here's a complete cut of the spinal cord at the T3 level. And when we do this and label the host axons, you can see here they approach the lesion site and they completely stop. They just don't regenerate. If we put a cell graft into the lesion site and provide it with growth factors, then some of these axons, just a few, will regenerate into the lesion site, and this is the best we'd ever done. About 100 grow a distance of 2 millimeters with a starting population of 1 million. So in terms of translational relevance, that ain't good. The best we'd ever done experimentally was to get about 100 axons to grow 2 millimeters, and that's not translationally relevant. So this illustrates this problem that the adult CNS doesn't regenerate. It also illustrates the value of animal models in observing this problem. So then this guy named Paul Liu in my lab suggested we look at neural stem cells because they have a high intrinsic growth capacity because they're early developmental neurons. I talked about this a couple of years ago, so I'll take you quickly through this to show you now how we apply genomics to this kind of discovery research to try and develop therapies. So this is the same T3 complete transection I showed you a moment ago. Again, the head is to the left, the tail is to the right. This is a 40 micron thick section. And occupying this lesion site now is a graft of neural stem cells. And we have genetically modified them to secrete green fluorescent protein, so you can unequivocally see the cells we have grafted into the lesion site and any axons that they may give rise to. And here's what they do. Here's what they do. Isn't that something? So compare this. So these are all axons growing out from the lesion site. So the T3 complete transection is here. And now these are axons emerging in remarkable numbers in linear arrays through the white matter that contains degenerating axons. So they grow like wildfire. And this is just exceptional biology. And this was an empirical finding. You could almost call it a serendipitous finding. We took these early-stage neural stem cells, made them green. And people had done this before, but they hadn't made them green, so they missed this. They missed the fact that these neural stem cells support this incredible growth of axons out of an injury site. Wouldn't it be nice to know why these axons emerge? There are a lot of other questions related to this. I'll go through some of them in a moment. But in the context of talking about this genomic era. Gee, we have the tools now to genomically probe these early stage neurons and see what they're expressing that might enable them to grow axons like that. If we define those molecular mechanisms now and apply them to injured adult neurons, then maybe we can recapitulate this kind of growth state and get adult axons to grow. But
where are the cell bodies for those axons?
In the lesion site.
So it's coming from the graft.
So this is the graft. You don't see all those axons in this image because we have to turn down the intensity of the green because this would otherwise glow too brightly and obliterate the image. So now if you move a little bit down from here, oops, wrong way. So now we move down the spinal cord from there. So now the graft is here, very bright green. These are all the axons emerging from it.
Does it connect rostrally?
I'll go through that now, John. Okay, but everyone's with me so far, right? Look at all these axons emerging. This comes from implanting neural stem cells. Oh, and by the way, one minor detail, these are human neural stem cells. These are human neural stem cells from the developing human nervous system, extending all of these axons through the rat. That's kind of wild, isn't it? That's just part of this wild state of science today. So what are neural stem cells? These are cells normally present during neural development. They are an early stage cell that's pluripotent. They can generate a neuron or a glial cell, and that means they can generate neurons, astrocytes, and oligodendrocytes. And there's a hierarchical progression of stem cell biology over development. We begin with a omnipotent embryonic stem cell at the 1 to 8 to 16 cell stage of embryonic development that can generate any cell type of the body. And by the way that different cell types are generated are by turning on certain genes and turning off certain genes. And that combination of on and off switches, remember we have a panel of 20,000 switches to choose from, a specific up and down pattern of gene expression determines the specification of every one of those different cell types in the body. So the embryonic stem cell has all of these switches in a neutral position, if you will. It turns on some of the switches, turns off some of the others, and now the cell, as it divides, is directed toward a neural fate, a neural stem cell fate, which is capable of generating neurons and glia. And now more switches are turned on and off as time progresses, and they begin to get restricted in their fate. And we refer to this as neuronal-restricted progenitor cells that at a certain stage can still become neurons and astrocytes, but they progressively become more committed over months of human development to generate mature neurons and astrocytes. And that's illustrated again here. So we begin with the embryonic stem cell. That's the natural cell that we all began from, present at the blastocyst stage. And again, as these switches, the genes are turned on and off, then some cells become neural stem cells. These can still divide, so they're self-renewing, but they are clearly committed based on the expression of a set of transcription factors to a neural fate. Now as more transcription factors get turned on, they begin to get driven further down the state of differentiation. We can isolate these cells from the brain or spinal cord and from them get a pool of cells that we call neural stem cells or multipotent neuroprogenitor cells. That's the cell type I showed you a moment ago in the spinal cord. And as more transcription factors are expressed and now molecules in the environment, proteins in the environment are turned on that affect gene expression in the cell, they start to become committed to either purely generating neurons, and now they're losing the ability to undergo multiple cycles of division, or they can become glia. So neuronal-restricted progenitor cells or glial-restricted progenitor cells. And finally, they generate mature neurons and astrocytes and oligodendrocytes. So the source of the cells I'm showing you are somewhere at the neural stem cell stage, the multipotent neuroprogenitor cell stage. They're capable of reconstituting both neurons and glia. And let me give you a little more detail on that, that in part will address some of your questions, John. So here again is that complete spinal cord transection site in the rat. These are, in this case, rat neural stem cells isolated from the developing rat spinal cord. And this is a marker showing that many of these cells over a 2-month period mature into neurons, neuon, marker of neurons. Many of the cells mature into astrocytes, GFAP as a marker of astrocytes. And many of the cells also develop into oligodendrocytes, using the label for oligodendrocytes called APC. And the proportion of cells that develop these fates over time are about 25% neurons, 25% oligos, and about 15% astrocytes. And again, this is what those cells sitting in the lesion site do. They send out these exorbitant number of axons. I told you that in the past we had achieved regeneration of about 100 axons over a 1 millimeter distance when trying to regenerate adult lesion neurons. Measure it using the same measurements, 30 to 50,000 axons grow that same distance, and they continue to grow for a distance of up to 5 centimeters. So now we're talking about distances that are relevant to human biology and numbers that are relevant to human biology. Because if we have somebody with a spinal cord injury, we implant neural stem cells in a lesion site, we can get the emergence caudally, and rostrally, because they're not restricted in growth in either direction, of very large numbers of axons over a 5 centimeter distance, a distance long enough to go from a mid-cervical lesion to a lower cervical motor neuron pool that could affect the hand. But that's very simplistic. We're talking about inserting a neuron that extends axons. For that to become a functional circuit, it has to hook up with the injured host circuitry, right? And would that happen? What we're really talking about is forming a neural relay, that a host axon now has to hook up with a stem cell-derived neuron in the lesion site, and that neuron in turn sends its axon out caudally. So far I've shown you one component of that arrangement, that the implanted neural stem cell can mature and send out axons in numbers that we never dreamed imaginable. By the way, here's a contusion in a rat. This is a severe contusion, so this would be like a person who's clinically complete below the level of their injury. And once again, numerous axon emergence. And this is, again, a human neural stem cell. So human cells can be obtained, grafted, survive, and extend axons. These are axons. They co-localize with axonal markers. And this shows that they grow from an injury site here at a rate of 1 to 2 millimeters per day. So now they're growing as fast as an injured peripheral nerve. So these really can grow. And they can grow through the inhibitory environment of the adult spinal cord. And I talked about embryonic stem cells, neural stem cells. Stem cell biology is another field of neuroscience that's progressing at a remarkable rate. We don't have to go to developing tissue anymore. We can derive these stem cells, these neural stem cells, from any one of we adults in the room here. And this is called induced pluripotent stem cell technology, where we take something like a skin biopsy, we grow up a fibroblast. In cell culture, we expose it to a set of transcription factors that identify cell fate, and that fully mature fibroblast will revert to an embryonic stem cell, now capable of generating every cell type in the body. And then we can drive that newly created embryonic stem cell that came from a terminally differentiated adult cell. We can now drive it forward to differentiate into a neural stem cell and reimplant that. And these days, we can do even more. We can take that adult fibroblast, and we don't even have to drive it all the way back to an embryonic stem cell anymore. We can drive it back only as far as a neural stem cell. Isn't that something? This is the crazy stuff of science fiction. That's the real science today. So we can take a fibroblast, an adipose cell, and with the proper cocktail of transcription factors, convert it into a neural stem cell. And we did this. We took skin cells from an 86-year-old man who was healthy. We used this set of transcription factors. First work was with Larry Goldstein here. And we implanted this in immunodeficient rats. Again, the lesion site is here. And here are 86-year-old human axons emerging from a spinal cord lesion site, growing through the inhibitory white matter, branching off their axons from the white matter into the gray matter and forming synapses. And here again, these are the 86-year-old human axons in the white matter seen at higher magnification here, sending off branches into the gray matter. The blue marks neurons. And this is 4 spinal segments below that injury in the immunodeficient rat, so it doesn't reject the cells. And these are the human axons descending below the injury site. I'll show you in a moment. Vicente. And here, higher magnification in the white matter. There are nearly as many human axons as there are rat axons that are contained in the core of this myelin here. These human axons are not myelinated at this stage, Vicente, because they're still developing. It's a side story we may not get to, but I'll show you rat neural stem cell myelination in a moment. So these axons emerge, and they grow for very long distances. If we implant them in a mid-cervical lesion site, here's their density in the white matter at C8, at T6, at T12, and at L4. You still have these axons traveling down in the white matter, branching off into the gray matter, and forming boutons that look like synapses. Am I crazy? Are they synapses? Yes. So here are these green axons traveling down the spinal cord. This is several spinal segments from that implantation site. We know that they're the green axons because by electron microscopy, we can label that green fluorescent protein darkly here. And here they are forming synapses with host cells. Here are those green axons terminating on a motor neuron below the spinal cord lesion site and expressing these synaptic markers. And they're myelinated. So here's the green axon traveling down the spinal cord, wrapped by the host spinal cord myelin. These are rat or mouse neural stem cells. Human neural stem cells take a year to develop in vivo, even when implanted into the rat. So the human axons don't become myelinated until at least a year later, which has real implications for thinking about translation. But I showed you their growth down the spinal cord. They also grow up. So again, implanted into a C5 lesion site that would be about here in the rat, here are these human axons now growing up into the brainstem, into the nucleus gracilis and cuneatus. Look at this. Look at this innervation of the sensory relay, the site of the primary axon projection of the sensory system into the medulla. So they're projecting rostrally as well as caudally. They're projecting far rostrally, even occasionally to the very end of the nervous system in the rat, the olfactory bulb. Right? So that's some potent biology. Will this be useful for neural repair? Well, let me show you that data now. But let me say first that, so we've tested a variety of types of stem cells, and they all do the same thing. This is an intrinsic property of neural stem cells implanted into the lesion adult nervous system. Mouse cells into mouse, human into rat, human into monkey, rat into rat, human into rat, human into rat, taking different types of stem cells, embryonic stem cell derived, spinal cord stem cell derived, and 86-year-old and other human-derived cells. They all result in the growth of very large numbers of axons over very long distances. So the biology is there and it exists. Reciprocally now, as we think about whether a circuit can be constructed, let's look at whether the host axons do indeed penetrate these grafts, and they do. So this is the cortical spinal projection of the rat. This again is a section through the spinal cord, a 40 micron section. The head is to the left, the tail is to the right. This is the neural stem cell graft, now colored red in the spinal cord lesion site. And this is the cortical spinal projection labeled by injections of tracers into the motor cortex in the rat. And here they are approaching the lesion site, and here they are regenerating into the neural stem cell graft in the lesion site, and pretty extensively. Up to this point, the spinal cord injury research field had been unsuccessful in promoting the regeneration of cortical spinal axons into lesion sites. And now this shows you pretty clearly that this refractory adult population now can indeed regenerate into the stem cell graft. Here it is, higher magnification. And here are just some additional sections to make the point. If we look early in the graft, here are the cortical spinal axons, now colored red. These are different experiments I'm showing you the data from. In the midpoint of the graft, many axons persist. In the end of the graft, the axon number is attenuated, but it's a big graft. And if we look at this particular smaller graft, here are the axons entering across the lesion boundary in the middle of the graft. At the end of the graft, and here at this point, axons emerging into the gray matter. So now, okay, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the regeneration of the adult axon. This isn't emergence of the stem cell axon. This is the adult axon. The adult axon grows into the gray matter, but not into the white matter. So white matter is broadly inhibitory to the growth of adult axons. and it's not inhibitory to the growth of stem cell-derived axons. But the adult axons will grow beyond the graft and into gray matter, where they can continue to grow in a somewhat linear fashion over distances of several millimeters. So these penetrating corticospinal axons form synapses. So now we've labeled the corticospinal axon black, and by EM, it's forming a synapse onto the dendrite of a stem cell in the graft in the lesion site, and it's co-localizing with synaptic proteins. So the neural stem cells fill the lesion site, establish physical connectivity. The neural stem cells extend axons out. The host axons regenerate in and form synapses. So there's the potential mechanism established to form a relay across the injury site, a synaptic relay. Does that happen? Well, if we take a stimulating electrode at C7 and measure a response at T6, so this is several spinal segments away from a graft placed in the lesion site, then we can record a response. So this is the normal response in the intact spinal cord. This is electrophysiological response after a transection. Now, if we graft the neural stem cells, we have the recovery of a response. It's a prolonged latency compared to the intact animals, suggesting there has been a synapse inserted, and its waveform is atypical to that of the natural state. Now, to confirm that this is really relay across the injury site, we can recut the spinal cord here when the graft has been present and the response was evoked, and now that response is abolished, indicating there is indeed synaptic transmission across the lesion site. Can that support functional recovery? So this is a motor assessment scale in rats. It's a 21-point scale. The animals with the lesion show a little bit of recovery, but not much, and it's stable over time. But animals that had the stem cell graft show recovery of a greater proportion. This is about the most that people ever describe in a spinal cord injury study. And again, if we recut above the graft so that we interrupt any host axons present, interrupt the relay, we abolish that recovery. So this seems to be real recovery. So the mechanism appears to be the formation of neural relays. And thinking of translation, we think, okay, what if we take this to a primate species? Let me go, in the interest of time, quickly and just show you same thing. So these are human spinal cord-derived neural stem cells. These are currently in clinical trials for ALS at other institutions. We take those same human cells, we make them green. We immunosuppress a monkey with a C7 hemisection lesion of the spinal cord. and we give it a human organ transplant immunosuppression protocol. And indeed, these human axons are now growing out from the lesion site in the rhesus monkey. Here in the white matter at the very end of the lesion block, we see this growth of many human axons through the spinal cord. They grow in the rostral direction too. They come out of the white matter, they penetrate the gray matter, and they have swellings morphologically that look like synapses. We're seeing now that they're synapses, and they grow for distances of 5 centimeters. Again, a clinically relevant distance. So this has translational potential, and it's of some interest. There are many questions that remain. They include, are there adverse effects of all of these axons growing out to ectopic sites? How many of these projections persist over time? A normal part of neural development is the pruning of unnecessary connections. How many of these might get pruned? Are there adverse functional consequences? Is there a worsening of pain? Is there a worsening of spasticity? These are all questions that have to be answered before one can think of rationally translating this sort of approach. And we're doing those studies now. We are interested in translation if the data drive it in that direction. But we're also interested in mechanism. We're interested in understanding why all this growth is happening. So this work now branches in two directions. One direction is a translational branch to see whether this can go into clinical trials with what we know. But the other is to better understand why is all this growth occurring? Why do these early stage neural stem cells have this high intrinsic growth capacity? What are the genetic mechanisms that enable it? That's one set of questions, and we can use genomic analysis to probe that using RNA sequencing of the cells we've implanted. I'm actually not going to talk about that further today. But I'll talk about the other basic question that comes up, which is, why are the adult axons suddenly regenerating? Everything we had done to cortical spinal motor axons in the past hadn't enabled their growth. After trying for 20 years, we had nothing until we implanted neural stem cells, and now they like it. Why do they like it? This is a question that personalized medicine can answer for us, potentially. And this is, and I'll now take you through briefly what it can do to illustrate its power, to illustrate what you might be able to do with it in the coming years in the clinic with your patients. And so, why do these corticospinal axons regenerate into these neural stem cell grafts? And we can combine genetic, epigenetic, and proteomic analyses to try and get at this. What at the level of the cell and in the environment of the stem cell graft is allowing their growth? And just to remind you, here are the corticospinal axons growing into this very large lesion site, but they're all over the graft. Here's another image. These are these corticospinal axons regenerating into a lesion site and sending off these large axons. Why? What are the? So there are two elements to this question. The first is, what is the corticospinal neuron itself up here in the motor cortex turning on as it regenerates? What are the sets of genes that are the essential mechanisms that drive its growth? If we identify those, then we can therapeutically turn them on more, or maybe turn them on longer, and increase the magnitude of that response or increase the distance over which it occurs. Similarly, they'll grow into the graft in the lesion site. And in data I didn't show you, they won't grow into a graft if they're not touching it. If you have any space at all between the cut site and the neural stem cell graft, even a gap as small as 20 microns, they won't penetrate it. That tells you they need to touch the graft. They need to make physical contact with the graft to regenerate. And that tells us that there has to be an extracellular matrix of the graft, or a protein in the extracellular matrix, or a transmembrane protein in the cells, in the membranes of the neural stem cells that are attaching to proteins on the corticospinal axon to enable its growth. So one question is, what are the sets of genes in the neuron itself that are turned on? The other question is, what are the sets of proteins in the neural stem cell graft that enable the growth? And so here's how we go about trying to probe those questions. First, we'll examine the RNA species of the corticospinal neurons as they're regenerating. And again, this offers the possibility of overexpressing those cellular mechanisms to further amplify regeneration. Secondly, in a separate set of studies, we're going to look at the protein compartment of the graft itself using proteomics analysis. What does the graft contain that supports this growth? We can, with tools available today, with proteomics and mass spectrometry, analyze the protein constituency of the entire graft. And whether we can actually detect all the proteins depends on the sensitivity of the assay method. The sensitivity is getting quite good these days. And so we can really fully probe the protein compartment of the graft. And this offers the possibility then, if we know what it is that the axons are interacting with, providing more of it so they grow better. Or taking out the stem cell graft entirely and making a bridge consisting of whatever that protein is that supports growth and enable the corticospinal axon to grow into and beyond the graft. So we can improve this growth potentially if we understand these fundamental mechanisms. So let's approach the genomics question first. So we perform RNA sequencing in the motor neurons of the cortex that are regenerating, and we compare it to the RNA pool in corticospinal neurons that are not regenerating. It's that simple, right? If you want to know what's being expressed during regeneration, compare the genome of the regenerating corticospinal neuron to the non-regenerating corticospinal neuron. In concept, that's simple. In practice, it's a little more complicated because when we sample the motor cortex that has the motor neurons, well, motor neurons aren't the only cell type up there, right? They're about 2 to 3% of the entire set of neurons in the motor cortex. Moreover, there are glia up there. So when we actually consider what the genomic pool is from a dissection of the motor cortex, the corticospinal population represents about 1% of that pool. So how do we probe just the genome of the corticospinal neuron? And the answer is we can. There exists today a mouse, nicely shown here in a beautiful illustration, a mouse that's called a backtrap mouse. So this is a mouse in which green fluorescent protein, which Roger Chen got the Nobel Prize for discovering a few years ago, there are mice available in which green fluorescent protein is present only in cortical spinal motor neurons. And moreover, the green fluorescent protein is only on the RNA, on the ribosomes in cortical spinal motor neurons. So if messenger RNA is attached to the ribosome and is being actively produced, actively translated, then it sticks to the ribosomes, GFP is stuck to the ribosomes. We can dissect out the motor cortex, run it over a column that has antibodies to GFP, and isolate that pool of mRNAs being actively produced in the cell just from the cortical spinal motor neurons. And this is called back trap technology. It allows us to specifically probe the pool of messenger RNAs just in cortical spinal motor neurons. And again, this is how it works. There's a GFP tag on the ribosomes. So as messenger RNA is attached to these ribosomes, it all gets stuck, and then we can purify the RNA that is attached just to the cortical spinal neurons, because they're the only neurons containing this GFP tag. So this is the experimental design. We have a mouse that's regenerating its cortical spinal tract because we've put a neural stem cell graft in its lesion site. We have a mouse that's not regenerating its cortical spinal tract because it's injured, but there's no graft in the lesion site. And we can sample it at 1, 3, 5, 7, 14, and 28 days after injury and get a temporal profile of the sets of genes that have to be turned on to enable regeneration. And this is the actual data from this experiment. So these are sets of genes that are turned on as a function of regeneration compared to a non-injured mouse. And this is that same genomic set in an injured mouse that isn't regenerating compared to the intact mouse. So first of all, each lane is a sample from one rat that's regenerating. The data are arranged in columns here. And each column here is a sample from a rat that is not regenerating.
Is this biopsy or peripheral blood?
This is taking out the brain and mashing up the brain, then pulling out the genome only of the cortical spinal neuron from the cortex. And the same gene is represented in the same line horizontally across this image. So here's sample 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And this red line is the same gene as this, 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 and this. So overall, you're seeing the raw data from 5 animals that are regenerating the cortical spinal tract. And overall, you see that the direction of gene expression is pretty well represented across the data set. The difference between these lanes here and these are that there are later time points in this data set. But generally, there's a lot of cohesion within this group of animals that are regenerating. And now look at those same genes in animals that are not regenerating. Look how different they are. So these genes are turned on as a function of regeneration. And in an animal that is lesioned but not regenerating, they're not. So these are the candidate genes that enable regeneration, and we know exactly what these genes are. Some genes are turned off as a function of successful regeneration, and they are not, by and large, turned off here. So it could be that some genes have to be turned on to regenerate, and some genes have to be turned off. They're switches, on and off. And sometimes you have to turn off a suppressor to enable growth to occur. And we certainly know there are lots of suppressors to growth in the adult nervous system. So again, successful regeneration is changing the transcriptional profile of the cell. Personalized medicine in Mr. Mouse here, who is regenerating, tells you that he's turning on a number of genes that are associated with successful regeneration, turning off others, and the mouse that is not regenerating is not showing the same pattern of activity. So this is a sample of the full genome, 20,000 genes. And of that complete list, about 2,500 are differentially expressed as a function of regeneration compared to those that aren't regenerating, using a statistical significance criterion that the change in expression is significant to a p-value of less than 0.01 and a false detection rate of 10%. So these are some of the statistical constraints that you put on the data set as you analyze it. This is part of the bioinformatics that goes into interpreting genomic data. at a very simple level. It gets much more complex than that. But fundamentally, this is the kind of data you get from such an analysis. So this tells you what the genes are. And this is showing that same analysis now in a little more detail over subsequent time periods across the data set. So again, each column is an individual animal. It's the genomic sequencing data from that animal. By the way, this consists of well over 100,000 probes and hybridization events to come up with these patterns. At 3 days, these genes are expressed. At 7 days, these genes, 14 days, and 14 days, another control group. So you can see these are the genes that are primarily correlate with early regeneration. I'm sorry, this is a non-regenerating data set, and these are regenerating. So again, all the genes are represented in this data set. One lane is data from one animal. So at 3 days, 7 days, and 14 days, the regenerating animal turns on and persistently keeps up the expression of this set of genes. And animals that's injured early on turns on some of the same genes, but it's not regenerating. So over time, the levels of expression of those genes fall. And that suggests that there's something that's activated early as a function of injury, which, if no signal for regeneration persists, gets down-regulated. So perhaps enhancing the expression of this set of genes will amplify regeneration. Sustaining it over time may amplify regeneration.
Mark, are you able, on such a fine grain, to say, let's take some section of the motor cortex of the mouse versus some other portion of the mouse and to say if there's something more global in the brain that's being turned on in these individuals versus the actual neurons being...
Yeah, Jim, we can do that. I'll show you a little data that speaks to that in just a second.
And certainly you probably could not do a hemisphere side, right? You could not do like what you do in the primates where you only do one half of the core. That's too small in the mouse, I'm sure.
Right. If you're wondering whether other neurons that aren't regenerating would show the same response, I'm not showing you data, but we have what's called the unbound fraction of the pool of mRNAs that just represent the rest of the brain from the same region. They don't show this pattern. This is a highly unique pattern to the regenerating cortical spinal neurons. And in fact, part of our analysis removes from this display any of those genes that are common because we assume they're less likely related to regeneration. So this analysis takes that caveat into account. So if you just look at the list of genes that are this most upregulated as a function of regeneration, here's a list. And some of these make sense in terms of regeneration, and some have no known relation to regeneration. Here's a growth factor receptor. This is a synaptic protein. This is a receptor for a signaling mechanism that mediates axon guidance during development. And this one highlighted in yellow is kind of interesting because this is a histone deacetylase gene that changes the conformational state of the chromatin that exposes some genes, some promoters now, to be turned on and some to be turned off as a function of the state of the cell. This is thought to be a global regulator of the transcriptional state of the cell. In other words, there's the possibility that this molecule is a key event that's changing the conformation of the DNA to enable a regeneration state. So very simplistically, maybe you give more HDAC5 and these cells suddenly change their chromatin configuration and become regenerators. Interesting possibilities. Yeah.
Mark, if you compare this sort of profile to human stem cells that are being simply cultured for X number of days, is this different? Does this overlap with the same number of mRNAs, similar ones that are simply related to neuron growth? Are there synergies and differences?
Yeah, so I will address exactly that point in a slide coming up. Our hypothesis underlying this is that successful regeneration represents a reversion of the adult neuron to a more stem cell-like state. And we don't have all the data in yet, Doug, but so far it does support that concept. We see a number of genes that are expressed reverting toward an earlier developmental state of the cell. Yes?
So you said that this is specific to cortical spinal neurons.
Yeah.
but yet when you did an injection into the lesion, it was the multipotent neural stem cell. So why aren't you seeing regeneration of the sensory tracts, of any sort of cerebellar tracts? Why is it just cortical spinal?
It's not just cortical spinal.
Okay.
So I just focused on cortical spinal because they're the most important motor system in humans. But other systems do regenerate.
But you said you also looked at the RNAs for the whole brain, and yet you said that you're not seeing the turn on.
So we looked at the RNAs from other cells in the motor cortex.
Okay.
So the only cells, of course, in the motor cortex that project the spinal cord are the cortical spinals. The others aren't regenerating. They haven't been lesioned. Does that make sense? So, sure. And we've also done this kind of analysis on a brainstem motor population, the rubrospinal projection in rats, and they have their own transcriptional profile. And actually, I'm about to show you the sensory profile. So, as long as you ask the question, not to intimidate you, but what do you predict? So, I've just shown you the unique signature, if you will, of regeneration of the cortical spinal projection. What do you think? You think that when we look at the sensory projection regenerating here, will it look the same? Will there be a global regeneration state of the adult neuron, regardless of sensory or motor cell type? Or do you think each population will be unique?
I imagine that each population is going to have a unique pattern of regeneration genes.
Well, I guess the opposite, but you're smarter than me because you guessed right. Let me just give you a little bit more on this cortical spinal data. So, you know, you get 100,000 reads or more from the RNA sequencing method. And so you need some way of dealing with this. As I showed you, 2,500 genes are differentially expressed. You need some means of sorting through these different genes and networking them. And so bioinformaticians, primarily coming from the cancer and immunology fields, have classified genes into related networks of function. And those sorts of bioinformatics tools are very helpful in sifting through the data. You can look at your list of most differentiated genes. Those are the most turned on and off, you would think would be particularly interesting, but they may not be the only sets of interest. And you need some tool to sift through all of the information. And there's software that does that. And here's an example of what an output from that looks like. So this is called ingenuity analysis. And it takes all of these differentially expressed genes. It considers them on a genome-wide basis based on the known functions of different transcription factors and genes and all that. And it networks them into images like this. So this is a regeneration network for the corticospinal system. And these are the key hubs. These things that have all this stuff coming in, arrows coming from various directions, are key genomic mechanisms that underlie the state of regeneration. And there are some expected players here, like ERK. ERK activation is an important part of the growth state of the cell. FOS expression is an immediate early gene that's thought to be related to cell activity. MYC is an oncogene, but it's a tumor suppressor gene. And in this particular case, it's suppressed, and that unleashes the growth state of the cell, apparently. NF-kappa-B is another candidate that comes up here. So you can begin to focus in on these families of molecules and sift through it using this bioinformatics approach to try and understand what's important. So these analyses, when you get 100,000 bits of data per sample, I mean, are complex and challenging. And there is a field of emerging bioinformatics, statistics, and medicine that tries to understand these relationships. This is a new area of medicine, and it's an area of very intriguing opportunity. You know, for the residents and medical students, you know, 10 years from now, even more so 20 years from now, people with this kind of knowledge will be in extraordinary demand in medicine, both in academic medicine and commercial medicine and real-time medicine. This is technology that we're all beginning to use in the clinical arena. I'm showing you how I apply these tools in the research setting, but all of these things and more sophisticated, is being brought into the clinical area. This is another way of looking at the information analysis. I think I'm going to skip through this in the interest of time and just tell you this really categorizes things, points out what the most important hubs are that are being turned on, and allows you then to take those important key hubs that have been identified and then experimentally change them to try and turn on growth or to block growth to see if it's a central mechanism in allowing this to happen. Now, back to your question. So is the transcriptome of the regenerating sensory neuron the same as the corticospinal neuron? And I already said you're smarter than me, so here. Here's the answer. Here's the regenerating corticospinal tract, and here's the regenerating dorsal root ganglion cell as it extends its axon centrally and regenerates into a graft or regenerates after a conditioning lesion of the peripheral nerve. So there are some common mechanisms, and there are some distinct mechanisms. Some things are turned down in both data sets, but other things are turned down in the corticospinal neuron that are not in the DRG neuron. And as you broadly look at the entire genome and how its genome-wide pattern of expression changes as a function of successful regeneration, you're impressed overall by perhaps more differences than more commonalities. And again, just to illustrate for you the tools that we use in analyzing this kind of data, this is a two-dimensional analysis of correlated genes that groups sets of genes together in hubs of networks. So I know this is too small for you to read, so I'm going to illustrate the data like this. In here are grouped the data that represent the transcriptome-wide pattern of expression in the non-regenerating corticospinal tract. Its genes cluster, this cluster analysis, they cluster up here. And this is the successfully regenerating corticospinal transcriptome. It clusters away, generally, from the non-regenerating data set, as you might predict. Here's the injured DRG data set. Notice that non-regenerating. Injured but non-regenerating. Notice it's clustered away pretty much from the regenerating CST data set, but even farther from the non-regenerating CST data set, but even farther away from the regenerating CST data set. Closer, though, to this than to this, right? So maybe some common genomic mechanisms of injury. But here's the regenerating DRG data set. It clusters away from the regenerating CST data set. Again, to the point that there are distinct genomic mechanisms, and it's also distinct from the injured DRG data set. So again, this is an analytical statistical tool to give you this broad picture of how the genome-wide pattern of expression changes. Yes? Time? Okay. So I think I'll just about stop there. That gives you a sense of how we use genomics in science and in medicine to try and understand relevant mechanisms, but now you can use those same tools coming up to direct therapy. We can do the proteomics analysis, but I won't go through it because of time, but basically it's informative. So wrapping up, this is really an extremely powerful tool that's just come online in the last 5 to 10 years. It's a powerful in discovery research, but this will be an expanding tool of importance in the clinical arena. And every one of us, to be competent physicians in the future, will need to have some working understanding of what this tool can provide us. Maybe not know how to manipulate the raw data and sift over the data sets, but know that this is where the data comes from, that there are various ways of looking at the results of it, and that it has implications for how we treat our patients. And I'll close there. Thank you for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.